Harold turned off the walkie-talkie, collapsed the antenna, and hung the radio on the handlebars again. But he sat astride the Honda for a moment without operating the Kickstarter. He was wearing an Army surplus flak jacket. The heavy padding was good when you were riding a cycle above 6,000 feet, even in August. But the jacket served another purpose. It had a great many zippered pockets, and in one of these was a Smith & Wesson 38. Harold took the pistol out and turned it over and over in his hands. Tonight. Why not? He had initiated this expedition on the chance that he might be alone with Stu long enough to do it. Now it looked as though he was going to have that chance in Chautauqua Park. He hadn't meant to go all the way to Nederland, a miserable little town nestled high above Boulder, a town whose only claim to fame was that Patty Hearst had once allegedly stayed there as a fugitive. But as he drove up and up, the Honda purring smoothly between his legs, the air as cold as a blunt razor blade against his face, something had happened. There had been a frightening yet exhilarating sense of magnetic attraction. And parked on his cycle at the end of Nederland's cheesy main street with the Honda's neutral light glowing like a cat's eye, listening to the winter whine of the wind in the pines and the aspens, he had felt something more than mere magnetic attraction. He had felt a stupendous, irrational power coming out of the west, an attraction so great that he felt to closely contemplate it now would be to go mad. He felt that if he ventured much further out on the arm of balance, any self-will would be lost. He would go just as he was, empty-handed. And for that, although he could not be blamed, the dark man would kill him. And so he had turned away feeling the cold relief of a pre-suicidal man coming away from a long period of regarding a long drop. But he could go tonight, if he liked. Yes, he could kill Redmond with a single bullet fired at point-blank range. Then just stay put, stay cool, until the Oklahoma sodbuster showed up. Another shot to the temple. No one would take alarm at the gunshots. Game was plentiful, and lots of people had taken to banging away at the deer who wandered down into town. It was 10 to 7 now. He could waste them both by 7:30. Fran would not raise an alarm until 10:30 or later, and by then he would be well away, working his way west on his Honda, with his ledger in his knapsack. But it wouldn't happen if he just sat here on his bike, letting time pass. The Honda started on the second kick. It was a good bike. Harold smiled. Harold grinned. Harold positively radiated good cheer. He drove off towards Chautauqua Park. Dusk was starting to close down when Stu heard Harold's bike coming into the park. A moment later, he saw the Honda's headlamp flashing in and out between the trees that lined the climbing sweep of the drive. Then he could see Harold's helmeted head turning right and left, looking for him. Stu, who was sitting on the edge of a rock barbecue pit, waved and shouted. After a minute, Harold saw him, waved back, and began to putt over in second gear. After the afternoon the three of them had put in, Stu felt considerably better than Harold. Harold's idea had been a damn good one, even if it hadn't panned out. And Harold had insisted on taking the Nederland route. He must have been pretty cold in spite of his heavy jacket. As he pulled up, Stu saw that Harold's perpetual grin looked more like a grimace. His face was strained and too white. Disappointed that things hadn't worked out better, Stu guessed. "Nothing at all, huh?" he asked Harold, jumping down nimbly from the top of the barbecue pit. "De nada," Harold said. The grin reappeared, but it was automatic, without strength, like a rictus. His face still looked strange and deadly pale. His hands were stuffed in the pockets of his jacket. "Never mind, it was a good idea. For all we know, she's back in her house right now. If not, we can look again tomorrow." "That might be like looking for a body." Stu sighed. "Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Why don't you come back to supper with me, Harold?" "What?" Harold seemed to flinch back in the gathering gloom under the trees. His grin looked more strained than ever. "Supper," Stu said patiently. "Look, Franny'd be glad to see you, too." "Well, maybe," Harold said, "but I'm..." Well, I had a thing for her, you know. Maybe it's best if we just let it go for now. Nothing personal. The two of you go well together, I know that. His smile shone forth with renewed sincerity. It was infectious. Stu answered it. Your choice, Harold, but the door's open any time. Thanks. No, I got to thank you, Stu said seriously. Harold blinked. Me? For helping us hunt when everybody else decided to let nature take her course, even if it didn't come to nothing. Will you shake with me? Stu put his hand out. Harold stared at it blankly for a moment, and Stu didn't think his gesture was going to be accepted. Then Harold took his right hand out of his jacket pocket. It seemed to catch on something, the zipper maybe, and shook Stu's hand briefly. Harold's hand was warm and a little sweaty. Stu stepped in front of him, looking down the drive. Ralph should be here by now. I hope he didn't have an accident coming down that friggin' mountain. Well, there he is now. Stu walked out to the side of the road. A second headlamp was now flashing up the drive and playing hide-and-seek through the screening trees. Yes, that's him, Harold said in an odd, flat voice behind Stu. Someone with him, too. What? There. Stu pointed to a second motorcycle headlamp behind the first. Oh. That queerly flat voice again. It caused Stu to turn around. You okay, Harold? I'm just tired. The second vehicle belonged to Glenn Bateman. It was a low-power moped, the closest to a motorcycle that he would come. And behind Ralph, Nick Andrus was riding Pillion. Nick had an invitation for all of them to come back to the house he and Ralph shared to have coffee and or brandy. Stu agreed, but Harold begged off, still looking strained and tired. He's so goddamn disappointed, Stu thought, and reflected that it was not only the first sympathy he had probably ever felt for Harold, but also that it was probably long overdue. He renewed Nick's invitation himself, but Harold only shook his head and told Stu he'd had it for the day. He guessed he would go home and get some sleep. By the time he got home, Harold was shaking so badly he could barely get his key in the front door. When he did get the door open, he darted in as if he suspected a maniac might be creeping up the walk behind him. He slammed the door, turned the lock, shot the bolt. Then he leaned against the door for a moment with his head back and his eyes shut, feeling on the verge of hysterical tears. When he had a grip on himself again, he felt his way down the hall to the living room and lit all three gas lanterns. He sat in his favorite chair and closed his eyes. When his heart had slowed a little, he went to the hearth, removed the loose stone, and removed his ledger. It soothed him. A ledger was where you kept track of debts owed, bills outstanding, accumulating interest. It was where you finally put paid to all accounts. He sat back down, flipped to the place where he had stopped, hesitated, then wrote, August 14th, 1980. He wrote for nearly an hour and a half, his pen dashing back and forth, line after line, page after page. When he was finished, he read what he had written while he absently massaged his aching right hand. He replaced the ledger and the covering stone. He was calm. He had written it all out of him. His resolve remained strong. That was good. The rage and fear and frustration had been safely transferred into the book with a rock to hold it down while he slept. Harold ran up one of the shades and looked out into the silent street. Looking up at the Flatirons, he thought calmly about how close he had come to just going ahead anyway, just hauling out the .38 and trying to mow all four of them down. That would have fixed their reeking, sanctimonious ad hoc committee. When he had finished with them, they wouldn't even have a fucking quorum left. But at the last moment, some fraying cord of sanity had held instead of giving way. He had been able to let go of the gun and shake the betraying cracker's hand. How, he would never know, but thank God he had. The mark of genius is its ability to bide. And so he would. He was sleepy now. It had been a long and eventful day. Unbuttoning his shirt, Harold turned out two of the three gas lamps and picked up the last to take into his bedroom. As he went through into the kitchen, he stopped, frozen. The door to the basement was standing open. He went to it, holding the lamp aloft, and went down the first three steps. Fear came into his heart, driving the calmness out. "Who's here?" he called. No answer. He could see the air hockey table, the posters. In the far corner, a set of gaily striped croquet mallets set in their rack. He went down another three steps. "Is someone here?" No, he felt there was not, but that did not allay his fear. He went the rest of the way down and held the lamp high above his head. Across the room, a monstrous shadow-like herald, as huge and black as the ape in the Rue Morgue, did likewise. Was there something on the floor over there? Yes, there was. He crossed behind the slot car track to beneath the window where Fran had entered. On the floor was a spill of light brown grit. Harold set the light down beside the spill. In the center of it, as clear as a fingerprint, was the track of a sneaker or tennis shoe. Not a waffle or zigzag pattern, but groups of circles and lines. He stared at it, burning it into his mind, and then kicked the dust into a light cloud, destroying the mark. His face was the face of a living waxwork in the light of the Coleman lamp. "You'll pay," Harold cried softly. "Whichever one of you it was, you'll pay. Yes, you will. Yes, you will." He went back upstairs and went through his house from end to end, looking for any other signs of the prowler. He found none. He ended in the living room, not sleepy at all now. He was just concluding that someone, a kid maybe, had broken in out of curiosity, when the thought of his ledger exploded in his mind like a flare in a midnight sky. The break-in motive was so clear, so awful, that he had nearly overlooked it completely. He ran to the hearth, pulled up the stone, and ripped the ledger from its place. For the first time, it came completely home to him how dangerous the book was. If someone found it, everything was over. He, of all people, should know that. Hadn't all of this begun because of Fran's diary? The ledger. The footprint. Did the latter mean the former had been discovered? Of course not. But how to be sure? There was no way. That was the pure and hellish truth of the matter. He replaced the hearthstone and took the ledger into his bedroom with him. He put it under his pillow along with his Smith & Wesson, thinking he should burn it, knowing he never could. The best writing he had ever done in his life was between its covers, the only writing that had ever come as a result of belief and personal commitment. He lay down, resigned to a sleepless night, his mind running restlessly over possible hiding places. Under a loose board? In the back of a cupboard? What about a safety deposit box at the bank? No, that wouldn't do. He wanted it with him, where he could look at it. At last he did begin to drift off. And his mind, freed by oncoming sleep, drifted along with no conscious guidance, a pinball in slow motion. He thought, it's got to be hidden, that's the thing. If Franny had hidden hers better, if I hadn't read what she really thought of me, her hypocrisy, if she had... Harold sat bolt upright in bed, his eyes wide. After a little time, he began to shiver. Did she know? Had that been Fran's footprint? Diaries, journals, ledgers. At last he lay down again, but it was a long time before he slept. And when he did, his dreams were uneasy, and more than once he cried out miserably in the dark, as if to ward off things that had already been let in forever. Stu let himself in at 9:15. Fran was curled up on the double bed, wearing one of his shirts, it came almost to her knees, and reading a book titled 50 Friendly Plants. She got up when he came in. "Where have you been? I was worried." Stu explained Harold's idea that they hunt for Mother Abigail so that they could at least keep an eye on her. He didn't mention sacred cows. Unbuttoning his shirt, he finished, "We would have taken you along, kiddo, but you were nowhere to be found." "I was at the library," she said, watching as he took off his shirt and slipped it into the net laundry bag hanging from the back of the door. Harold had read her diary, she knew that now. She had been terribly afraid that Harold might connive to get Stu alone and, well, do something to him. But why now, today, just when she had found out? If Harold had let the sleeping dog lie this long, wasn't it more logical to assume that he didn't want to wake the dog up? And wasn't it just as possible that by reading her diary, Harold had seen the futility of his constant chase after her? Coming on top of the news that Mother Abigail had disappeared, she had been in a ripe mood to see ill omens in chicken entrails. But the fact was, it had simply been her diary Harold had read, not a confession to the crimes of the world. And if she told Stu what she had found out, she would only succeed in looking silly and maybe getting him pissed at Harold, and probably at herself as well for being so silly in the first place. "How did Harold seem?" she asked. Stu was taking off his pants. "Pretty well racked. Sorry his idea didn't pan out better. I invited him to supper whenever he wanted to come. I hope that's okay by you. You know, I really think I could get to like that sucker. You never could have convinced me of that the day I met you two in New Hampshire. Was it wrong to invite him?" "No," she said, after a considering pause. "No, I'd like to be on good terms with Harold." "I'm sitting home thinking that Harold might be planning to blow his head off," she thought, "and Stu's inviting him to dinner. Talk about your cases of the pregnant woman vapors." Stu said, "If Mother Abigail doesn't show up by daylight, I thought I'd ask Harold if he wanted to go out again with me." "I'd like to go too," Fran said. "And there are a few others around here who aren't totally convinced that she's being fed by the ravens. Larry Underwood's one of them." "Okay, fine," he said, and joined her on the bed. "Say, what you wearing under that shirt?" "A big, strong man like yourself should be able to find that out without my help," Fran said primly. It turned out to be nothing. The next day's search party started out modestly at 8 o'clock with half a dozen searchers. But by noon, the party had swelled to 20, and by dusk there were better than 50 people combing the brush west of Boulder, stepping all over each other's CB transmissions and generally confusing the issue. A strange mood of resigned dread had gradually replaced yesterday's acceptance. Despite the powerful force of the dreams that had accorded Mother Abigail a semi-divine status in the zone, most of the people had been through enough to be realists about survival. The old woman was well past 100, and she had been out all night on her own. And now a second night was coming on. The fellow who had struggled across the country from Louisiana to Boulder with a party of 12 summed it up perfectly. He had come in with his people at noon the day before. When told that Mother Abigail was gone, this man, Norman Kellogg by name, threw his Houston Astros baseball cap on the ground and said, "Ain't that my fucking luck? Who you got hunting her up?" Charlie Impening, who had more or less become the zone's resident doom crier, he had been the one to pass the cheerful news about snow in September, began to suggest to people that if Mother Abigail had bugged out, maybe that was a sign for all of them to bug out. After all, Boulder was just too damn close. Too close to what? Never mind, you know what it's close to. And New York or Boston would make Mavis Impening's boy Charlie feel a whole hell of a lot safer. He had no takers. People were tired and ready to sit, at least until after the mass meeting. Resigned dread was as far as the community's feelings went, Glenn Bateman believed, because these were still rationally minded people in spite of all the dreams, in spite of their deep-seated dread concerning whatever might be going on west of the Rockies. Superstition, like true love, needs time to grow and reflect upon itself. When you finish a barn, he told Nick and Stu and Fran after darkness had put an end to the search for the night, you hang a horseshoe ends up over the door to keep the luck in. But if one of the nails falls out and the horseshoe swings points down, you don't abandon the barn. The day may come when we or our children may abandon the barn if the horseshoe spills the luck out, but that's years away. Right now, all we feel is a little strange and lost, and that will pass, I think. Franny said, you don't really think our grandchildren are going to be superstitious natives, do you, Glenn? Burning witches and spitting through their fingers for luck? I can't read the future, Fran, Glenn said, and in the lamplight his face looked old and worn, the face perhaps of a failed magician. I couldn't even properly see the effect Mother Abigail was having on the community until Stu pointed it out to me that night on Flagstaff Mountain. But I do know this. We're all together in this town because of two events. The superflu we can charge off to the stupidity of the human race. It doesn't matter if we did it or the Russians or the Latvians. Who emptied the beaker loses importance beside the general truth. At the end of all rationalism, the mass grave. The laws of physics, the laws of biology, the axioms of mathematics, they're all part of the death trip, because we are what we are. If it hadn't been Captain Trips, it would have been something else. The fashion was to blame it on technology, but technology is the trunk of the tree, not the roots. The roots are rationalism, and I would define that word so. Rationalism is the idea we can ever understand anything about the state of being. It's a death trip. It always has been. So you can charge the superflu off to rationalism if you want. But the other reason we're here is the dreams. And the dreams are irrational. We've agreed not to talk about the simple fact while we're in committee, but we're not in committee now, so I'll say what we all know is true. We're here under the fiat of powers we don't understand. For me, that means we may be beginning to accept, only subconsciously now and with plenty of slips backward due to culture lag, a different definition of existence. The idea that we can never understand anything about the state of being. And if rationalism is a death trip, then irrationalism might very well be a life trip. At least unless it proves otherwise. Speaking very slowly, Stu said, "Well, I got my superstitions. I know it don't make any difference if a guy lights two cigarettes on a match or three, but two don't make me nervous and three does. I don't walk under ladders and I never care to see a black cat across my path. But to live with no science, worshiping the sun maybe, thinking monsters are rolling bowling balls across the sky when it thunders, I can't say any of that turns me on very much, Baldy." "But suppose those things were true," Glenn said gently. "What? Assume that the age of rationalism has passed. I myself am almost positive that it has. It's come and gone before, you know. And suppose that when rationalism does go, it's as if a bright dazzle has gone for a while, and we could see..." He trailed off. "See what?" Fran asked. He raised his eyes to hers. They were gray and strange, seeming to glow with their own inner light. "Dark magic," he said softly. "A universe of marvels where water flows uphill and trolls live in the deepest woods and dragons live under the mountains. Bright wonders, white power. Lazarus come forth, water into wine, and just maybe the casting out of devils." He paused, then smiled. "The life trip," he said. "And the dark man?" Fran asked quietly. Glenn shrugged. "Mother Abigail calls him the devil's imp. Maybe he's just the last magician of rational thought, gathering the tools of technology against us. And maybe there's something more, something much darker. I only know that he is, and I no longer think that sociology or psychology or any other ology will put an end to him. I think only white magic will do that. And our white magician is out there someplace, wandering and alone." Glenn's voice nearly broke, and he looked down quickly. Outside there was only dark, and a breeze coming down from the mountains threw a fresh spatter of rain against the glass of Stu and Fran's living room. After a while, Glenn and Stu kindled a blaze in the fireplace, and they all watched the flames without saying much. After they were gone, Fran felt low and unhappy. Stu was also in a brown study. "He looks tired," she thought. "We ought to stay home tomorrow. Just stay home and talk to each other and have a nap in the afternoon. We ought to take it easy." She looked at the Coleman gas lamp and wished for electric light instead. Bright electric light you got by just flicking a wall switch. She felt her eyes sting with tears. Then, suddenly, Stu brightened. "By golly, I damn near forgot, didn't I?" "Forgot what?" "I'll show you. Stay right here." He went out the door and clattered down the hall stairs. She went to the doorway, and in a moment she could hear him coming back up. He had something in his hand, and it was a... "Stuart Redmond, where did you get that?" she asked, happily surprised. Folk arts music, he said, grinning. She picked up the washboard and tilted it this way and that. The gleam of light spilled off its bluing. Folk? Down Walnut Street a ways. A washboard in a music store? Yeah, there was a hell of a good wash tub, too, but somebody had already poked a hole through it and turned it into a bass. She began to laugh. She put the washboard down on the sofa, came to him, and hugged him tight. His hands came up to her breasts, and she hugged him tighter still. The doctor said give him jug band music, she whispered. Huh? She pressed her face against his neck. It seems to make him feel just fine. That's what the song says anyway. Can you make me feel fine, Stu? Smiling, he picked her up. Well, he said, I guess I could try. At 2:15 the next afternoon, Glenn Bateman burst straight into the apartment without knocking. Fran was at Lucy Swan's house, where the two women were trying to get a sourdough sponge started. Stu was reading a Max Brand Western. He looked up and saw Glenn, his face pale and shocked, his eyes wide, and tossed the book on the floor. What's wrong? He asked Glenn sharply. Did someone find her? No, Glenn said. He sat down abruptly as if his legs had just given out. It's not bad news, it's good news, but it's very strange. What? What is? It's Kojak. I took a nap after lunch, and when I got up, Kojak was sleeping on the porch. He's beat to shit, Stu. He looks like he's been through a mixmaster with a set of blunt blades, but it's him. You mean the dog? That Kojak? That's who I mean. Are you sure? Same dog tag that says Woodsville, New Hampshire. Same red collar. Same dog. He's really scrawny and he's been fighting. Dick Ellis, Dick was overjoyed to have an animal to work on for a change. He says he's lost one eye for good. Bad scratches on his sides and belly, some of them infected. But Dick took care of them. Gave him a sedative and taped up his belly. Dick said it looked like he'd tangled with a wolf. Maybe more than one. No rabies, anyhow. He's clean. Glenn shook his head, and two tears spilled down his cheeks. That damned dog came back to me. I wish to Christ I hadn't left him behind to come on his own, Stu. That makes me feel so friggin' bad. It couldn't have been done, Glenn, not with the motorcycles. Yes, but he followed me, Stu. That's the kind of thing you read about in Star Weekly. Faithful dog follows master 2,000 miles. How could he do a thing like that? How? Maybe the same way we did. Dogs dream, too. Didn't you ever see one lying fast asleep on the kitchen floor, chasing rabbits? Glenn shook his head in a dazed way. You're saying he dreamed? I'm not saying anything funnier than what you were talking last night, Stu reproached him. Glenn grinned and nodded. Oh, I can talk bat stuff for hours on end. I'm one of the great all-time bullshitters. It's when something actually happens. Awake at the lectern and asleep at the switch. Fuck you, East Texas. Want to come over and see my dog? You bet. Glenn's house was on Spruce Street, about 2 blocks from the Boulderado Hotel. The climbing ivy on the porch trellis was mostly dead, as were all the lawns and most of the flowers in Boulder. Without daily watering from the city mains, the arid climate had triumphed. Kojak was lying on the porch, his tattered snout laid peacefully on his forepaws. The dog was rack-thin and pitifully chewed, but Stu recognized him, even on short acquaintance. He squatted and began to stroke Kojak's head. Kojak woke up and looked happily at Stu. In the way that dogs have, he seemed to grin. "Say, that's a good dog," Stu said, feeling a lump in his throat. He thought of all the dogs he'd had since the pup his dad had given him when he was 4. A dog was a good thing to have, and so far as he knew, Kojak was the only dog in Boulder. He glanced up at Glenn and glanced down quickly. He guessed even old bald sociologists didn't like to get caught leaking around the eyes. Good dog, he repeated, and Kojak thumped his tail against the porch boards, presumably agreeing that he was indeed a good dog. Going inside for a minute, Glenn said thickly. Got to use the bathroom. Yeah, Stu said, not looking up. Hey, good boy, say old Kojak. Wasn't you a good boy? Ain't you a one? Kojak's tail thumped agreeably. Can you roll over? Play dead boy, roll over. Kojak obediently rolled over on his back, rear legs splayed out, front paws in the air. Stu's face grew concerned as he ran his hand gently over the stiff white concertina of bandage Dick Ellis had put on. Further up, he could see red and puffy-looking scratches that undoubtedly deepened to gores under the bandages. Something had been at him, all right. Wolf pack, maybe. But Stu doubted if Kojak could have gotten away from a pack. Whatever, he had been lucky not to be disemboweled. The screen banged as Glenn came back out on the porch. Whatever it was got at him didn't miss his vitals by much, Stu said. He patted Kojak on the rump, and Kojak rolled back onto his belly. How is it almost all the dogs are gone, and there's still enough wolves or coyotes in one place to set on a good dog like this? I guess we'll never know, Glenn said, any more than we'll know why the goddamned plague took the horses but not the cows, and most of the people but not us. I'm not even going to think about it. I'm just going to lay in a big supply of Gainsburgers and keep him fed. Yeah. Stu looked at Kojak, whose eyes had slipped closed. He's tore up, but his doings are still intact. I saw that when he rolled over. We could do worse than to keep our eye out for a bitch, you know it. Yes, that's so, Glenn said thoughtfully. Want a warm gin and tonic, East Texas? Hell no. I may never have gone any further than 1 year of vocational technical school, but I'm no fucking barbarian. Got a beer? Oh, I think I can scare up a can of Coors. Warm, though. Sold. He started to follow Glenn into the house, then paused to look back at the sleeping dog. You sleep good, old boy, he told the dog. Good to have you here. He and Glenn went inside. But Kojak wasn't asleep. He lay somewhere between, where most living things spend a good deal of time when they are hurt badly, but not badly enough to be in the mortal shadow. A deep itch lay in his belly like heat, the itch of healing. Glenn would have to spend a good many hours trying to distract him from that itch so he wouldn't scratch off the bandages, reopen the wounds, and reinfect them. But that was later. Just now, Kojak, who still thought of himself occasionally as Big Steve, which had been his original name, was content to drift in the place in between. The wolves had come for him in Nebraska while he was still sniffing dejectedly around Mother Abigail's house. The scent of the man, the feel of the man, led to this place and then stopped. Where had he gone? Kojak didn't know. And then the wolves, four of them, had come out of the corn like ragged spirits of the dead. Their eyes blazed at Kojak, and their lips wrinkled back from their teeth to let out the low, ripping growls of their intent. Kojak had retreated before them, growling himself, the hair along his back stiffened up into hackles, his tail drooping low and pushed out over his tensed-up balls, his paws stiff out and digging at the dirt of Mother Abigail's dooryard. To the left hung the tire swing, casting its depthless, round shadow. The lead wolf had attacked just as Kojak's hindquarters slipped into the shadow cast by the porch. It came in low, going for the belly, and the others followed. Kojak sprang up and over the leader's snapping muzzle, giving the wolf his underbelly, and as the wolf began to bite and scratch, Kojak fastened his own teeth on the wolf's throat, his teeth sinking deep, letting blood, and the wolf howled and tried to struggle away, its courage suddenly gone. As it pulled away, Kojak's jaws closed with lightning speed on the wolf's tender muzzle, and the wolf uttered a howling, abject scream as its nose was laid open to the boars and pulled to tatters and strings. It fled, yipping with agony, shaking its head crazily from side to side, spraying droplets of blood to the left and right, and in the crude telepathy that all animals of like kind share, Kojak could read its over-and-over thought clearly enough. Wasps in me, oh, the wasps in my head, wasps are up in my head, oh. And then the others hit him, one from the left and another from the right like huge blunt bullets, the last of the trio submarining in low, grinning, snapping, ready to pull out his intestines. Kojak had broken to the right, baying hoarsely, wanting to deal with that one first so he could get under the porch. If he could get under the porch, he could stand them off maybe forever. Lying on the porch now, he relived the battle in a kind of slow motion. The growls and howls, the strikes and withdrawals, the smell of blood that had gotten into his brain and had gradually turned him into a kind of fighting machine, unaware of his own wounds until later. He sent the wolf that had been on his right the way of the first, one of its eyes dead and a huge gouting and probably mortal wound in the side of its throat. But the wolf had done its own damage in return. Most of it was superficial, but two of the gores were extremely deep, wounds that would heal to hard and twisting scar tissue like a scrawling lowercase T. Even when he was an old, old dog, and Kojak lived another 16 years, long after Glenn Bateman died, those scars would pain and throb on wet days. He had fought free, had scrambled under the porch, and when one of the two remaining wolves, overcome with bloodlust, tried to wriggle in after him, Kojak sprang on it, pinned it, and ripped its throat out. The other retreated almost to the edge of the corn, whining uneasily. If Kojak had come out to do battle, it would have fled with its tail between its legs. But Kojak didn't come out, not then. He was done in. He could only lie on his side, panting rapidly and weakly, licking his wounds and growling deep in his chest whenever he saw the shadow of the remaining wolf draw near. Then it was dark, and a misty half-moon rode the sky over Nebraska. And each time the last wolf heard Kojak alive and presumably still ready to fight, it shied away, whining. Sometime after midnight it had left, leaving Kojak alone to see if he would live or die. In the early morning hours he had felt the presence of some other animal, something that terrified him into a series of soft whimpers. It was a thing in the corn, a thing walking in the corn, hunting for him, perhaps. Kojak lay shivering, waiting to see if this thing would find him, this horrible thing that felt like a man and a wolf and an eye, some dark thing, like an ancient crocodile in the corn. Some unknown time later, after the moon went down, Kojak felt that it was gone. He fell asleep. He had laid up under the porch for 3 days, coming out only when hunger and thirst drove him out. There was always a puddle of water gathered below the lip of the hand pump in the yard, and in the house there were all sorts of rich scraps, many of them from the meal Mother Abigail had cooked for Nick's party. When Kojak felt he could go on, he knew where to go. It was not a scent that told him. It was a sense of heat that had come out of his own deep and mortal time, a glowing pocket of heat to the west of him. And so he came, limping most of the last 500 miles on 3 legs, the pain always gnawing at his belly. From time to time he was able to smell the man, and thus knew he was on the right track. And at last he was here. The man was here. There were no wolves here. Food was here. There was no sense of that dark thing, the man with the stink of a wolf and the feel of an eye that could find you over long miles if it happened to turn your way. For now, things were fine. And so thinking, so far as dogs can think, in their careful relating to a world seen almost wholly through feelings, Kojak drifted down deeper, now into real sleep, now into a dream, a good dream of chasing rabbits through the clover and timothy grass that was belly high and wet with soothing dew. His name was Big Steve. This was the North 40. And oh, the rabbits are everywhere this gray and endless morning. As he dreamed, his paws twitched. Chapter 43. Excerpts from the minutes of the ad hoc committee meeting, August 17, 1980. This meeting was held at the home of Larry Underwood on South 42nd Street in the Table Mesa area. All members of the committee were present. The first item of business concerned having the ad hoc committee elected as the permanent Boulder committee. Fran Goldsmith was recognized. Fran. Both Stu and I agree that the best, easiest way for us all to get elected would be if Mother Abigail endorsed the whole slate. It would save us the problem of having 20 people nominated by their friends and possibly upsetting the apple cart. But now we'll have to do it in another way. I'm not going to suggest anything that isn't perfectly democratic, and you all know the plan anyway, but I just wanted to reemphasize that each of us has to make sure we have someone who will nominate and second us. We can't do it for each other, obviously. That would look too much like the mafia. And if you can't find one person to nominate you and another to second you, you might as well give up anyway. Glenn Bateman said that he had intended to address the committee on the subject of our scouts or spies or whatever you want to call them, but that he wanted to make a motion instead that we meet to discuss that on the 19th. Stu asked him why, and Glenn said, "Because we might not all be here on the 19th." That was good for a moment of silence, and then the committee voted 7-0 to meet on the 19th as a permanent committee to discuss the question of scouts or spies or whatever. Stu was recognized to put a third item of business before the committee concerning Mother Abigail. Stu. As you know, she's gone off for reasons of her own. Her note says she'll be gone for a while, which is pretty vague, and that she'll be back if it's God's will. Now, that's not very encouraging. We've had a search party out for 3 days now, and we haven't found a thing. We don't want to just drag her back, not if she doesn't want to go, but if she's lying up there somewhere with a busted leg or if she's unconscious, that's a lot different. Now, part of the problem is that there just aren't enough of us to search all the wild lands around here. But another part of it is the same thing that's slowing us down at the power station. There's just no organization. So what I'm looking for is permission to put this search party on the agenda of the big meeting tomorrow night, same as the power station and the burial crew. And I'd like to see Harold Lauder in charge, because it was his idea in the first place. Glenn said that he didn't think any search party was going to find very good news after a week or so. After all, the lady in question is 108 years old. The committee as a whole agreed with that, and then voted in favor of the motion, 7-0, as Stu had put it. To make this record as honest as possible, I should add that there were several expressions of doubt over putting Harold in charge, but as Stu pointed out, it had been his idea to begin with, and to not give him command of the search party would be a direct slap in the face. Nick. I withdraw my objection to Harold, but not my basic reservations. I just don't like him very much. Ralph Brentner asked if either Stu or Glenn would write out Stu's motion about the search party so he could add it to the agenda, which he plans to print at the high school tonight. Stu said he'd be glad to. Larry Underwood then moved that we adjourn. Ralph seconded it, and it was voted 7-0. Francis Goldsmith, secretary. The turnout for the meeting the next evening was almost total, and for the first time, Larry Underwood, who had only been in the zone a week, got an idea of just how large the community was becoming. It was one thing to see people coming and going on the streets, usually alone or by twos, and quite another to see them all gathered together in one place, the Chautauqua Auditorium. The place was full, every seat taken, and more people sitting in the aisles and standing at the back of the hall. They were a curiously subdued crowd, murmuring but not babbling. For the first time since he had gotten to Boulder, it had rained all day long, a soft drizzle that seemed to hang suspended in the air, fogging you rather than wetting you. And even with the assemblage of close to 600, you could hear the quiet sound of rain on the roof. The loudest sound inside was the constant riffle of paper as people looked at the mimeographed agendas that had been piled up on two card tables just inside the double doors. Larry found that his nervous hands had been busy folding his agenda, which he knew nearly word for word, into a paper airplane.